Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're focusing on something I think everyone feels. It's that constant nagging feeling of technological and economic overwhelm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we're always just one software update away from being irrelevant, and we're fighting to learn faster just to stay in the same place.
It really is the central challenge of modern life. For decades, we've sort of internalized this message that survival means individual optimization.
Right.
Learn every new tool, build the perfect signal network, automate yourself into this state of hyper-efficiency. The pressure is just relentless.
And honestly, unproductive. We feel this intense pressure to individually solve these massive system-wide shifts.
Exactly. Whether it's AI or climate instability or, you know, huge economic restructuring.
But our sources today, they suggest this whole mindset is, well, misdirected.
Mm.
And they're pulled from this fascinating discussion between systems thinkers, entrepreneurs, a tech ethicist.
And guided by an elder from a community that's actually survived 200 years of continuous change.
Which is an incredible perspective to have.
It really is. And that's the core tension we're going to unpack. Individual optimization works beautifully in stable systems.
When the rules are clear.
When the rules are clear, the future's predictable, you right. should absolutely optimize your personal path then. But when the ground is fundamentally shifting, I mean, when you're in a genuine phase transition, individual optimization just fails.
Because the goalposts are moving too fast.
Right. The context changes faster than you can adapt. So the crucial shift is from asking, how do I personally survive this, to how do we collectively build infrastructure that actually works?
I love that shift from sort of philosophy to pure mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
So let's break that down. Why does trying to learn everything alone fail?
Yeah.
The sources lay out four incredibly practical, almost purely mechanical reasons why individual effort is just mathematically inferior to doing this together.
And what's fascinating is how unsentimental this argument is. It's not about feeling warm and fuzzy.
Yeah.
It's about efficiency, distributed effort, and just intelligent risk management.
Okay, so let's start with the most obvious one. The first constraint, speed. The sources say the speed of change now just exceeds our ability to adapt as individuals.
Think about the tools everyone is scrambling to master right now. You know, Claude, Cursor, Devin, all these cutting-edge AI assistants.
Right.
A technologist in our source group said that the mastery cycle for a new complex tool is often longer than the tool's lifespan.
Wow.
Yeah. So by the time you've spent 100 hours becoming competent, the tool is already superseded, or the entire landscape has just shifted from under you. Trying to learn faster is futile.
You're just chasing a moving target.
Mm-hmm.
So if the pace is faster than one person can handle, what's the collective mechanical solution?
You distribute the learning burden. It's just simple math applied to cognitive load.
Mm-hmm.
One person spending 100 hours gets you, well, 100 hours of competence. But if you have 10 people who each spend 10 hours and then share their findings,
you get 100 hours of community competence.
In just 10 hours of collective time.
That's a huge cut in the time to competence for the group.
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't that require, I don't know, constant meetings, high stakes communication?
Not really. The key insight for you, the listener, is you don't need to learn everyone's tools. You just need to specialize in your small piece, commit to sharing what you find, what worked, what failed, and you let the network become competent collectively.
So it's about specialization and sharing.
Exactly. And it's not just about speed. It's about redundancy. If your learning path fails or gets invalidated by some market change, the other 9 experiments protect the collective knowledge base.
Okay, so if the pace is too high, the next barrier has to be cost. That brings us to reason number 2. The resources required exceed what one person can do.
This is so critical for entrepreneurs and small business owners. Say you want to experiment with, I don't know, using AI to deliver your service, or maybe a cooperative ownership model or a new subscription structure.
You can only afford to try one or two things.
And if you pick wrong, the individual risk, the potential for total failure, is just cripplingly high. You can't personally afford a full R&D portfolio.
So the solution is to treat the network like a portfolio.
You apply portfolio theory. Exactly. 10 people can each try 5 different, maybe low-risk approaches. That gives you 50 collective experiments.
That's distributed R&D.
It is. And the individual risk just plummets. The community can afford for some experiments to fail because the successes of the network lift everyone up.
I get the math, but this assumes all the experiments are, you know, equally valuable.
Right.
What if I try something totally irrelevant? Doesn't that just distribute bad data?
That's a fantastic point, and it's why the sources emphasize sharing the failures just as much as the successes.
Oh, okay.
Knowing why Approach X failed prevents 9 other people from wasting their capital and time on that same flawed strategy. It's an efficiency mechanism disguised as vulnerability.
That clarifies things a lot. So we've solved for speed and risk. Let's talk about knowledge quality. Reason 3, signals exist in networks, not individuals.
Right. How do you spot what's needed before it's obvious to everyone?
Yeah.
Pattern recognition fundamentally improves with network size. If I'm one person and I'm in, say, 3 coffee bars, a few forums, a couple client meetings, I see mostly noise.
It's all specific to your little world.
Exactly. But if 10 people are in 10 different contexts, different markets, different tech stacks, the signals that appear across multiple observers, those are real.
That's the key. Seeing the same pattern show up in uncorrelated places.
Yeah.
That's how you filter signal from noise.
Precisely. Collective sense-making provides that critical filter. Consistent patterns are likely real trends, isolated patterns, probably just noise or bias or a fad. You can't get that level of filtering alone.
Okay, so the final mechanical reason, 4. This one addresses the catastrophic end of failure. You need risk tolerance, which requires collective insurance.
Yes. Individual failure, losing a job to automation, a big project collapsing, a health crisis, it can be catastrophic when you're on your own.
So you need mutual aid. But you define it here not as charity, but as transactional collective insurance. Why that distinction?
Because it's based on reciprocal obligation. Everyone contributes when they're strong, knowing they can draw on it when they're weak. This is why the elders' community survived 200 years. Their success wasn't about maximizing individual profit.
It was about making sure no single catastrophe could wipe out the whole group.
Exactly. Historically, that meant rebuilding a burned barn. For knowledge workers today, that can be financial-like rotating credit funds, or it can be time-based.
Time-based aid, like childcare co-ops or skill swaps.
Perfect examples. Helping each other hit a deadline, or swapping expertise when someone needs a new skill they don't have time to learn alone. But crucially, this requires vulnerability. Our culture trains us to project relentless success, but mutual aid requires sharing reality. It means admitting when you're struggling so the network can actually absorb that shock.
You have to admit you're weak for the network to make you strong.
That's it, exactly.
So if I boil that down, we're basically swapping individual mastery for network redundancy. It's a very clean case against going it alone.
It is. But the mental barriers are just as strong as the mechanical benefits. As soon as you present this model, people raise some really clear objections that keep them locked in that individual struggle. We have to tackle those directly.
Okay, let's do it. Let's start with the isolation barrier. I'm a remote worker, maybe a freelancer. I don't have a network. Objection 1, how do I build a community from scratch?
Start small. You don't need 100 people. You need what the sources call a minimum viable community, an MVC.
Okay. What does that look like?
3 to 5 people. That's it. And they need to be navigating a similar transition. Maybe you're all moving from corporate to consulting, or you're all artists trying to use AI. And the commitment is simple.
Huh?
Meet monthly for 90 minutes.
So that shifts the burden from this big, scary thing called building a network to just starting a conversation.
Exactly. Find people you already know, colleagues, contacts, people you respect in online forums, and just invite them. Don't wait for the perfect structure. You just have to start.
Okay, objection 2. This one might be the hardest for driven professionals. I'm competing with these people for jobs. Why on earth would I share my learnings and give away my edge?
There are 2 critical responses to this. The first is about mindset. If you believe jobs are a scarce, fixed pie, then, yeah, collaboration feels threatening.
But if the whole field is expanding,
which it is right now, then collaboration makes everyone better positioned. The whole group moves faster than the outside competition.
And the second response goes back to what's being commodified, right?
It does. You're competing on the wrong thing if you're hoarding information. Mm. If you compete on technical skills, which AI is rapidly commodifying, then yeah, sharing hurts. But if you compete on collective capacity, who has the best sense-making network, the deepest shared context, then collaboration is your competitive advantage.
So sharing information makes your network anti-fragile.
While hoarding it makes you brittle, success becomes non-zero sum.
That is a powerful reframe. Okay, the most common one I hear. I'm already overwhelmed. Objection 3. I don't have time for a 90-minute monthly meeting.
You don't have time not to do this. I mean, if you're spending 10 or 15 hours every week solo trying to figure things out, hitting roadblocks, getting nowhere.
Then 90 minutes with five other people doing the same thing is just more efficient?
Demonstrably, mathematically more efficient.
It's the barn raising for knowledge work. It looks like an extra chore, but it's actually faster, and it builds the relationships you need for the next crisis.
You're distributing the cognitive load, accelerating learning, and you reduce that awful feeling of having to solve every single problem yourself.
Okay, final objection. Free riding. What if I commit, but someone else just shows up, takes the insights, and never contributes?
This is why the size is so important. Free riding is extremely difficult in a tiny relationship-based community of 3 to 5 people. If someone consistently takes without giving, everyone knows immediately. The gap is just glaring.
And the sources say the response isn't punishment.
Absolutely not. The response has to be relational. It's a conversation. Hey, we notice you've been struggling to contribute. What's going on? How can we help? The value is the participation, so someone truly can't or won't participate. They often just self-select out.
Because they can't maintain the honesty required.
Right. Keep it small, keep it accountable, and the free riding issue tends to resolve itself.
Okay, we've covered the why and we've cleared the mental barriers. For the listener who is ready to start their minimum viable community, what does that 90-minute practice actually look like? Give us the template.
Sure. We can break it into 4 distinct segments. It moves from vulnerability to collective strategy.
Okay, let's unpack this structure.
First, minutes 0 to 15, the check-in. This is where you establish vulnerability. Everyone shares their actual reality, not their professional, everything's fine facade.
What's been hard this month? What challenge derailed your plans?
Exactly. You need the real, unpolished status updates to build trust.
Then minutes 15 to 45 is experiments and learnings.
This is the distributed R&D report. What specific thing did you try? What worked? And crucially, what failed? What surprised you? This is where the raw data gets shared.
And from there, minutes 45 to 75. Sense making.
This is the moment of collective intelligence. The group steps back and asks, what patterns are appearing across all our experiments? What did the person in marketing and the person in engineering both observe?
Ah, so you're filtering for those cross-context signals we talked about.
Precisely. This elevates the group's intelligence above any single individual. And then finally, minute 75 to 90, commitments and support.
The accountability loop.
Right. What small experiment will each person commit to for next month, based on what you just learned? And what specific support do they need from the group to actually do it?
That's it. It's a simple structure, but repeated monthly, it creates this engine for learning and support.
It absolutely does. It drastically reduces individual effort and risk.
Okay, that structure is so simple and actionable. Let's look at the viability. The sources gave 2 great examples. First, tell us about the AI tool learning pod.
Okay, so imagine 5 independent programmers. They form one of these pods. Their shared experiment was integrating 3 different complex AI coding assistants into their workflow.
And after 3 months of these meetings,
the collective wisdom emerged. They figured out. Use the powerful model, like Claude, for architectural design. Use the fast, iterative one, like Cursor, for implementation. And then build a custom wrapper for specific internal workflows.
What was the time savings on that?
It was huge. That collective knowledge, that optimal division of labor, would have taken any one of them 6 months of trial and error to figure out alone.
Assuming they even had the capital to test all 3.
Exactly. They literally halved the learning curve through deliberate shared sense making.
And the second example shows the risk absorption function, the mutual aid during crisis.
Right. A small network of 5 freelancers, they set up a modest rotating emergency fund and a clear protocol. When one member unexpectedly lost a huge contract.
They lost their job, basically.
Total job insecurity. The fund was activated. It covered their basic living expenses for 3 months. And the network provided leads and just intensive emotional support.
So it was a safety net. But what was the long-term benefit?
Because they had that 3-month shock absorber, that individual was able to avoid the desperation that forces you to take the very first job offered.
Right.
They spent the time conducting a proper search, vetting opportunities, and ultimately took a much better, higher-paying, long-term job.
Whereas without the aid, they would have burned through savings
yeah.
and probably taken a worse position out of sheer panic.
Exactly. The community absorbed the shock, and the individual bounced back stronger, which validated the whole network's investment in each other.
So what does this all mean? The core message here is, well, it's extremely compelling.
The real power of this is that you don't have to convince society or your company to adopt it. You just start practicing it with a small, trusted group. And the results, the efficiency, the reduced risk, the collective intelligence, they speak for themselves. You become anti-fragile while others are still operating in this brittle, isolated way.
It's the ultimate shortcut to being well-informed and resilient. You really cannot do it alone during these massive phase transitions, but you don't have to. Collective infrastructure, that distributed learning, portfolio risk, pattern recognition, and mutual aid, that persists.
And the transition doesn't start with everyone adopting it. It starts with small, viable clusters forming and just demonstrating a better way of operating.
So here's our final provocative thought for you to chew on. If the alternative is navigating this alone and probably failing, and the solution is these small, intentional practice circles, who are three people you could invite into a simple monthly 90-minute practice circle to see what emerges in the next 6 months?
Don't wait for the crisis and don't wait for perfect conditions. Just start.